Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. This hour, co-housing. If you're not familiar with the term, it's because there isn't a lot of it in the United States. But in places like Denmark and other European countries, it seems to be catching on. In Denmark, somewhere between 1 and 8% of people live in some form of co-housing. In the U.S., it's less than 0.01%, but maybe 10 years from now, that number will be much, much higher. Co-housing, what exactly it is, why it may be attractive to baby boomers who are beginning to retire now in large numbers. Our guest wrote a very interesting article in the Atlantic's City Lab. It is titled, Can Boomers Make Co-Housing Mainstream? And we'll be talking with Chris Bentley about the article in just a moment. Later in the hour, we will be speaking with one of the initial founders of and project manager for Stone's Throw Eco Village in Viroqua, Wisconsin, which is a co-housing community which is getting underway. And we'll be welcoming phone calls. Does this strike you? Won't you hear more, of course, about what it is as something that would be an interesting way to live at some point in your life? 800-486-8655 is our number. 800-486-8655. Chris Bentley is a freelance writer based in Chicago and Midwest editor of the Architects newspaper. His work has appeared in the New York Times, the Chicago Tribune, and many other publications. And we thank you very much, Chris Bentley, for joining us this hour. Hello.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Yeah, thanks, Chris. So do you want to give us a definition of what co-housing, or would you have to give us a lot of definitions because it plays out differently if you're in Denmark or Viroqua?
Yeah, that's the thing. It can play out pretty differently depending on who's doing the project and where it is. But the general idea is some sort of shared housing development that has the goal of creating an intentional community. So rather than, you know, your neighbors just being whoever happens to move in next to you, you're living beside and in some cases with a group of people that share your interests or for some reason have come together around a common idea. Mm-hmm. And the physical form that often takes is a multi-unit housing development that might be organized like a condo association or a townhouse association in many cases, but is much different in spirit than a lot of those more typical housing types.
Mm-hmm.
And this idea started in Denmark, has caught on in Germany in about the 70s. But it's come to the U.S. since, and it's, as you mentioned in the intro, a lot less common here. But I guess as we'll hear later in the hour from Stone's Throw, get some good examples of where it has been successful in the U.S.
And you write about the gentleman who pioneered the model in Denmark in the late 70s and late 60s and early 70s. You say that he brought together friends and like-minded utopians. There's a word you don't hear very much anymore, utopians, to get together to live like this.
Well, sure. I mean, it definitely is a little bit of an ideological pursuit in a sense. Although, you know, just to be clear, I heard from everyone that I talked to that it's not as, I guess, as hippie, for lack of a better term, as you might think. It ends up being a problem sometimes when co-housing developments, who really have to be very, you know, hard-nosed financiers in some sense to get something like this off the ground. When they want to move into a community, there's a lot of pushback in some cases where neighbors wonder, you know, is this some sort of commune? What am I dealing with here? And in reality, it's much more just it could be five families, it could be 100 families, depending on the size of the development, that all agree they want private space. They want their own kitchen in many cases, in most cases. They certainly want, you know, their own bedrooms. But they also want to share spaces. They want a common courtyard or a common kitchen to do meals together once a week, or they don't need everyone having their own laundry room. They might share them, or maybe they decide they do. But in most cases, they're sharing some resources, usually sharing space, and then sort of sharing the governance of that common space. And that can take all sorts of different forms, but it's kind of sitting in between this, you know, need for privacy and this pursuit of a larger community.
Hmm. But it's not really an answer to a lack of affordable housing. These can be somewhat pricey, can't they?
Right, and that can be for a number of reasons. First off, just that idea of having a lot of shared spaces, and in many cases, these are custom designed. You know, it's not as if this is a common housing type, and they can take so many different forms. One co-housing group might want a music room because they're all musicians. That's going to be an added expense. Some might want all sorts of sustainable features, which may pay back in the long run, but at the outset, it hasn't generally been much cheaper, or in some cases any cheaper than comparable housing, say comparable condos in the markets it's taken off in the U.S. But they are looking. I know there's a co-housing association as a nonprofit that sort of keeps an official track of this trend, and they're working on some initiatives, I believe, to make it more of an affordable housing type. But you're right, at the moment, it's not really a solution, or it's not really supposed to be a solution to the affordable housing crisis.
Mm-hmm. And why is it, do you think, it's taken off in such a big way in places like Denmark?
Yeah, that's a good question. I mean, in one sense, it's just it's been there for longer. It's where it started. But I think there's much more to it than that. There's just more of a communal spirit, I'm told. I've never been, but in Denmark, and certainly we know about lots of, interesting, cutting-edge, sustainable development and smart growth going on in Copenhagen and other places in northern Western Europe. And, that speaks to just a sense of wanting to forge this kind of intentional community that ideologically fits in with this co-housing model. That also translates, I think, to some specific, political, some economic, some zoning differences. It might be easier to sell this idea to a community. We're going to have a dense development of a lot of families living together. They may be sharing, let's say, in some cases, utility metering. There's a little less red tape in some of the communities in Denmark, or these have taken off as Baugruppen, which I apologize for probably mangling the pronunciation of that.
It's all right.
In Berlin, which means a group of buildings. So in cities like Berlin and Copenhagen, where there has been more of a communal mindset, and you have a lot of laws that reflect that, these developments tend to do much better than they have in the U.S.
Mm-hmm. And is it intentional to have people of all different ages living in co-housing, or does it tend to be people who are baby boom generation or people who are raising children and want some help raising each other's children to make it easier on certain families? What's the setup?
Yeah, that can also take a number of different forms. In fact, when co-housing was first talked about and kind of forged in Denmark, it did center around raising children in some cases. There was a kind of seminal essay about child rearing, the kind of old idea of it takes a village, but in the sense of contemporary Denmark, the title translates to children should have 100 parents. And that was the idea, that you would have a group of families living together, taking obviously, the primary role in parenting their own children, but they would also interact with, and in some cases parent, and supervise and play with and all those things with their neighbor's children. So you kind of have a larger family unit than just the traditional nuclear family. And in the U.S., that's also the case with a lot of co-housing. It's also the case with other co-housing, that the group of people that's come together for a particular development happen to be baby boomers, as you mentioned. They maybe are retiring. Maybe they don't need as much space. They want to live in a small, walkable right. community. They want neighbors they're close with. And so it can take that form. And it can shift over time, too, as people leave. They decide to sell their stake in the co-housing development and move on. Someone else might move in. Maybe they're with children. Maybe they're retired. It can be pretty multi-generational.
Uh-huh. We'll start taking phone calls in a moment. Let's give you a Facebook comment here, though, from Julie, who says, well, let's just call them what they were in the 60s, communes.
Yeah, I'm not sure. I wasn't around in the 60s. I've read about communes a little bit, and my sense is that they are similar in some ways and very different in others, that is, co-housing developments and communes. they're similar in the sense that they do share, I think, an ideological aspect, that they enjoy this. There's this idea of intentional community, you know, having neighbors who aren't just people you put up with or pass by on the street or say hi to every once in a while, but people that you actually truly live with and share, have a common stake in, you know, protecting shared resources or just being close in the real sense. When it comes to how they're different, I think communes definitely have a connotation of, I guess, something less official or certainly less tied to an investment in real estate. I mean, they could just be a group of people who share an idea and meet here or there, given them the week, or maybe they camp somewhere. But to me, although I guess I could be corrected on this, I think communes are somewhat less organized or less official, or usually, in some cases, I think it could be also more insular. Co-housing, well, you know, I don't want to make too much of this ideological point, you know, can be pretty inclusive. There can be people that enjoy private space a lot and just want one aspect of the common shared space, whereas others in the same development might be all about, you know, cooking together every night. But there's kind of flexibility in there for everybody.
We welcome phone calls. We're talking about co-housing this hour of the program with Chris Bentley. And Chris is a freelance writer. He's based in Chicago. He's Midwest editor of the Architects newspaper. His work has appeared in a number of publications. He wrote a piece about co-housing that appeared in the Atlantic, actually the City Lab from the Atlantic, and it looked really interesting, a different way of living and catching on a little bit in the United States, more popular in Europe, and we're talking about what it is and why it might be an attractive way to live for many people, and what the problems are in making it happen. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show, and we're on Twitter @KDunnShow. Pat in Mazamani is our first caller for you. Hi, Pat.
Hello. I'm sure the person who's on probably recognizes this person, but I've been reading a lot lately about Ross Chapin, who's an architect out in the Northwest, and designs what he calls, I believe, pocket neighborhoods. And they're tiny homes that are about 8 homes, less than 1,000 square feet per acre, with a central interior area. And they're dotting up, I think, around Seattle and Oregon and that area. And they require probably different thinking about zoning concepts around here. But it seems like certainly I'm of the age group that's thinking about downsizing eventually. And it appeals to me because they're individual homes. They aren't necessarily around a central unifying idea like you've been talking about. They could just be for people who want to live a smaller lifestyle. Maybe have share a car or something like that. I mean, there could be other all kinds of ways you could organize them. But I like the idea of smaller homes that are around a central area that's not segregated by age or anything. You know, this appeals to me a lot. But I've never seen anything like that talked about in Wisconsin. The person who screened me said that they know of something like that happening in Madison, which I wasn't aware of. So I don't know. Maybe you could talk about that, too.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks very much for the call. Chris. And we do have some.
Yeah, I did come across Ross Chapin, actually, those architects in the Northwest, the caller mentioned. And pocket neighborhoods is a really good example, I think, of one of the forms that this idea can take. And you're absolutely right. That doesn't have to be around a strong central idea. It's not, you know, it could be a bunch of musicians or artists who want to share a creative space, but more often it's just a bunch of people, and the only thing they share is the things you mentioned, that they want to live, they don't need as much space necessarily as they had maybe when they were raising a family, or for whatever reason they, you know, co-housing didn't work for them earlier in their life, and they are moving into a new phase and retiring maybe and want a different kind of life. They want to live near people, but, you know, not constantly sharing space with them, and maybe they share cars, like you said. Certainly a great example of that. And it does, I think it definitely, that reflects larger trends, and that's why I decided to focus on boomers in this respect, in that people want, and it's not just boomers, but certainly, you know, compared to what they had had before, more walkable communities, you know, living closer to people that they consider friends and neighbors, and a sense of community that, you know, they maybe was lacking in the traditional car-centric subdivision. And this is one way they can do that.
Well, and I think it's one of the most difficult things about getting very old is this being lonely, being isolated. It's wonderful to have people around you.
Yeah, I mean, it's really a basic human need. And I heard a lot of, talk when I was researching the story about, well, if we act like the co-housing model is a strange one, but really people lived in large, you know, units larger than the nuclear family for a long time in human history. And only, you know, since we really pushed the model of urban sprawl and car-centric development and suburban subdivisions, did we kind of get away from that? And I think there is just generally, you know, a larger yearning for closeness in that kind of community.
More phone calls in a moment. 800-486-8655 is the number. Co-housing is what we're talking about this hour on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. All right, let's go back to phone calls. Mark is next in Milwaukee. Hello, Mark.
Good afternoon, Kathleen and Chris.
Hi.
Thanks for having this program.
Sure.
I'm a member of an intentional community in the Bayview neighborhood of Milwaukee called the Bayview Eco Village.
Hmm.
We use the co-housing model for our two duplexes and 13 members. I'm hoping you can speak to different urban versus rural versus suburban co-housing communities, and also to how many communities use conventional housing stock, meaning no long planning periods, land acquisition issues, and expensive buy-ins.
Yeah, is that what you're doing in Bayview?
No, we bought current houses. We bought our two duplexes that were side by side, and we shortcut the whole process, because I think a lot of times communities start from scratch, and it's just like a 10-year period before they're actually living in their communities.
Mm-hmm.
It took us 1 year, basically. Mm.
And when you call it yours an eco-village, what do you mean by that, Mark?
We have two duplexes, and we're an intentional community. We have three community dinners, so we're an intentional community, not a commune. We stay away from that word, and it's worked out great. We've been around for 7.5 years
now
and saved a lot of money, actually, because of things like shared internet, family phone plans. We have a great garden here, so we do a lot of community stuff, and I think it's been a fabulous experiment.
Yeah, and do people stay?
Yeah, I'd say we average probably 3 to 4 years, pretty much average time that, you know, Americans move or whatever. You know, and people move for different reasons, but we've had a number of us have been here the whole time, so, and we've got new members too, which brings new energy and ideas and talent. So it's been great to have new people mix it up with us as well.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Mark, for the call. What about the idea of using existing housing, Chris?
Yeah, I think that's a great point that he makes about, shortcutting can be a really long and onerous process. You know, development is not an easy business, and a lot of people, you know, no matter what you're developing, whether it's a single-family home that, you know, in a guaranteed to sell soon neighborhood, or something more complicated or unusual as a large co-housing development might be in many communities in the U.S., that can take years. You know, it will take years, and as Mark mentioned, it can take 10 years, which that can be a frustrating and in some cases unacceptable time to wait. Of course, you know, if you're planning on buying and living in a home, that can be plenty of time to hammer out all these details, like how is this going to look and how is it going to work. But to buy existing housing and move in there, certainly in Milwaukee, in Chicago, and in communities all over the country, there's you know, a wealth of underused building stock that could be retrofitted or changed slightly to accommodate new families and new lifestyles. And I think that's a great example.
Yeah. Thank you so much, Mark, for your call. And also joining our conversation for a while is Jerry McIntyre. Jerry is one of the initial founders of and a project manager for Stone's Throw Eco Village. It's in Viroqua, Wisconsin. He's lived in the co-housing community of Rosewind in Port Townsend, Washington as well. Jerry, thank you for joining our conversation.
I'm glad to be here.
Are you up and running now in Viroqua, or is it a work in progress?
Well, the short answer is it's a work in progress. We're up and running as far as we feel because we've come together as a group and agreed on a vision together, and we've put our first capital investments in, and we bought property. So we're on our way.
Yeah, well, you've done a lot. What's your vision?
It's to build a sustainable, people-oriented neighborhood that will be close enough to walk or bike to the center of town and that will enable us to share resources and conserve through that sharing.
Mm-hmm. And will you be building this? It will be new housing?
Yes. It will be new construction. It's on land that is bare, 12 acres at the moment. And there is an old existing house that we will repurpose in some way. But most everyone will build a brand new home there.
How did you find everybody?
Well, we put word out in the usual ways in a small town. Viroqua, as you know, is a small town of just 5,000 people.
Mm-hmm.
So we put notices up at the Viroqua Food Co-op and all the other places that people hang out, and we put notices up online, and maybe more importantly going forward, we're also listed on the online directories at cohousing.org, which is the website for the National Cohousing Association, and also at the Fellowship for Intentional Community, which is ic.org. Those are the two largest directories of communities across the U.S.
Mm-hmm. And do you imagine that what you are creating now will, in terms of money, turn out to be less expensive than living on your own as a single family or living by yourself or however most people live in single family houses?
Right, right. Well, we're in a single family house. I'm part of a family of three. And it certainly will decrease our expenses. It will cost us around the same, I think, as the home that we're currently in, but our new home will be smaller, and yet we will share in a number of common facilities that will enable our home to be smaller so that our expenses will be lower, you know, on an annual basis, monthly and annual basis.
Mm-hmm. And how do you decide, this is a tricky process, who's in and who's not in?
Well, that's an interesting one. There are groups that decide who gets to join and who doesn't, but that's not co-housing. It's another type of community. Co-housing communities are open to anyone who wants to join, and it's basically a self-selection process. People who want to be part of designing their own neighborhood and people who want to be part of managing their own neighborhood going forward, those are the people who are going to want to come in and join.
Mm-hmm. Do you want to take this the same question, Chris? Are most communities, whoever wants to join, what motivates you is to be sustainable and to design your own neighborhood. What about if you want to make sure that people are parents so that you can have a lot of people available for helping you take care of children or people who are elderly and may have health care needs?
Yeah, absolutely. My understanding of it is definitely that it is an open community. And I think that has to do, in some cases, for legal reasons. You know, if you want to organize, for example, as a condo association, I don't think you can prevent certain types of people from joining, for example.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, as was brought up, it doesn't tend to be a problem, as far as I know, since the kind of people that would come together and invest, you know, mentally and also financially in such a development would already kind of be self-selecting. So I haven't heard of, although it certainly could be the case, of, you know, having a problem with organizing who goes into a specific development and how they get along. You know, generally that it is an open community, and you end up with people that get along because they share ideas and they are invested in the same thing.
Yes. And Jerry, when do you expect to have your first homes built?
Well, we are hoping to start construction before this year is out.
Mm.
There are a couple different ways of building in a co-housing community. One is to design all of the housing at once and build it all at once. And another is called the lot development model, where members buy a lot and they build their own homes on their own timetable. And that's the model that we're following in our rural co-housing project.
I see. All right. Stay with us. We're going to go to many more phone calls. Melissa in Decorah, Iowa. Hi, Melissa.
Hi.
Hi.
Can you hear me?
Oh, yes.
All right. Okay, I have a question regarding zoning, and it pertains to a specific example is a current collective, I guess. It's a couple of families who co-own land, and there was one family who originally purchased it in Fillmore County, Minnesota, in 1995, and at the time, it's rural land, so it's zoned agriculturally. And at the time, they were allowed 5 building permits. And so they started gathering some friends together to plan to build their homes there. And since then, up to now, zoning has become more restrictive for rural development in that county. And that's really important so that, well, for a variety of reasons, because it's agricultural land. However, it limits the possibilities for new parties to join their collective. And they're currently working with a zoning administrator who's extremely supportive, but there really isn't anything written in the ordinance that includes co-housing models. So it's kind of a new thing for the current zoning administrator and for the people involved in that collective. And I'm wondering what comments maybe, Chris, you have on that or advice.
All right. Thank you, Melissa.
Yeah. As far as advice, I'm not sure because I'm, you know, not a zoning attorney or anything like that. But certainly the description that the picture you paint is really interesting because I think it illustrates how there are indeed some zoning challenges for these. In most communities, many communities, I should say, these don't have really a model for this. And it might just be as simple as upzoning for more density in many cases where you have something rural or even in a city, maybe you have it for a single family home. You want to build, you know, a couple families worth of residents on the property. It may be as simple as going to the alderman or the city council or the village board or whatever it is and working with that through the public process. If that is the case, then that's, you know, that's added time and sometimes expense and labor, certainly for the people who are trying to get the community off the ground. So that can be a headache, but it certainly isn't insurmountable. It does illustrate, though, that, you know, this model is new for a lot of places. Although, as you mentioned, that lot was originally had more density than it is now allowed. So it also kind of gets at, you know, what the temper of the community is. Has it changed since the land was developed? And then is it changing now in a way that, you know, the community has to catch up with? Or in some cases, maybe co-housing isn't right for a certain community.
Mm-hmm. Did you have problems with zoning, Jerry?
That's a good question. Our property is in a township that has no zoning.
Oh.
But I can add a little something about zoning because I have been part of other co-housing communities. I know that probably more than 50% of the 130 co-housing communities that are in existence in the country have had to get a variance to zoning or filed for an individual planned unit development in order to get built in the area because of zoning. It can be done. Like Chris said, it's a little more work. But when the planners see that you mostly want to concentrate the housing in one area and yet you still want to keep appreciable green space, then the spirit of the zoning is still intact. You're not just trying to stack too many units on a piece of land. You're just orienting them or locating them a little differently on the total area.
Right. Thanks, Melissa. Hope that was helpful for you. Ron in Clam Lake, Wisconsin. Pretty area there. Hi, Ron.
Thank you, Kathleen.
Hi.
And Chris and Jerry for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
I lived in a community on the west side of Madison called Crestwood. And your guest and writer might know about the Wisconsin Cooperative Housing Association, which was formed in 1936. And it was a group of state government workers who got together and bought 80 acres of land and established through some cooperative agreements a community which was very far-reaching community. My wife and I and family lived there from 1973 until 1991.
Mm.
And it was just a wonderful experience because we cooperatively owned 27 acres of forest lands.
Oh, nice.
That backed on each backyard of every home.
Oh.
The community owned the parks and maintain their own parks, and to my knowledge, it is still, they have a board of directors and stocks and bonds and investments that they use to improve the community.
So it is a long-lived thing that's going on there. That's wonderful.
It really is. It had victory gardens during the war that the community could share in. They cooperatively maintained streets and pathways. And it was in close proximity to a Crestwood school, so all the children could walk to school safely.
Mm-hmm. Chris, you want to comment?
It sounds lovely. I wasn't familiar with it, but getting everyone together to invest together in their own future, in a very literal sense, having that trust with stocks and bonds. I guess it is. I don't know if it's trust technically or not, but that can be powerful, beyond just the idea of having people share an idea. If you're having people share control of the future of their community, that can be pretty transformative, I would imagine.
And Ron, were there other places in Wisconsin that had similar communities?
Not to my knowledge.
No.
There wasn't. I think this was the first cooperative housing. In fact, I think if you look up Wisconsin Cooperative Housing, it was formed under the state laws of cooperatives, and it was I think one of the first, if not in Wisconsin, in the country, a cooperative housing association formed in this manner. So.
It sounds like it was just lovely.
Great place to raise a family, great friendships, and I should point out it was the home of Gaylord Nelson and Spencer Black, and I'm not sure if Spencer Black still lives there, but they all shared in the future development, in later years of the community.
Yeah, fascinating. That's fascinating. I'll have to learn more about that. Thank you very much, Ron, for your call. Fawn in Madison is next. Hi, Fawn.
Hi.
Hi. Hello. Fawn is not there anymore. Please call us back. Something happened. We're talking about co-housing this hour of our program and welcoming your phone calls. Our number is 800-486-8655. Chris Bentley has informed many about co-housing, which started really in Europe, and it was big in Denmark and still is back in the 60s and early 70s. Chris is a freelance writer based in Chicago. He's Midwest editor of the Architects newspaper, and his work has appeared in many publications. He wrote about this whole issue in current City Lab from the Atlantic. Also joining us, Jerry McIntyre. He's been through the whole process of getting people together and getting ready to begin construction on co-housing. He's one of the initial founders of and project manager for Stone's Throw Eco Village in Viroqua, Wisconsin. And Jerry has also lived in other co-housing communities in this country. So back to you. Our phone calls in a moment. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. All right, let's return to your phone calls, and we'll try Fawn again in Madison. Hello, Fawn.
Great. Thanks very much again. And I would like to talk about two parallel co-housing groups that are getting started on the east side of Madison at Union Corners, which is at the intersection, will be at the, I mean, it is at the intersection of East Washington and Milwaukee Street, and it's part of a planned development that's going in the next year or two, and right in on the same site is room for two co-housing projects. And so there are two groups, because there's room for two of them, there are two groups that are planning simultaneously, and I've been involved in both of them because the process interests me so much, and so do each of these groups. One of them is called Madison East Side Co-Housing, and the other is called Co-Housing at Union Corners. Both can be found on Facebook. If you just search for Madison East Side Co-Housing on Facebook, you'll come up with both of those. They each have their own character, and one of them plans for an apartment building with, I don't know, 30, maybe 35 or 40 units of different sizes, and also like underground parking, you know, that's important to the members. And the other group will have a mixture of types of buildings, such as townhouses, as well as a few condo style, you know, units. And so each will have a common space, their common house, and shared grounds. And what I love about co-housing is that you get to, I mean, I wouldn't draw a distinction between co-housing and communes, and I'd like to put that matter to rest because they are so distinct. There is a great book out called Creating Co-Housing, Building Sustainable Communities, and it's quite comprehensive and recent, and they draw a clear distinction between co-housing and some of the more intensive forms of intentional community. Communes, for example, are an extreme form of community, and very often all income and assets are held in common for the whole group. Often they're formed around a single charismatic leader. That's quite different from co-housing, which requires a group of people to be interested and put the legwork into making it happen, as well as it's all about private ownership mixed with certain assets held in common for the greater good. For example, like you said, we don't all necessarily need to own a lawnmower or a large laundry area or something, although individual units might choose to have their own laundry, but laundry facilities. But a lot of people think that it's just cheaper and more convenient to share some of these assets. And then people can sign up for maintenance tasks that suit them. For example, if I feel like being really active, I might sign up for the snow shoveling crew or the lawn or the gardening and, you know, landscaping crew. Someone who felt less active might do more of the bookkeeping, for example, or some of the various, you know, indoor tasks that don't quite require as much energy. I mean, mm-hmm. physical energy. Mm-hmm. And so it really accommodates a wide variety of types of people and skills and stages of life. And I really and my husband and I are both very, very interested in the multi-generational community to live in. So that's why we're looking into it. Nothing is set in stone, and there's room for plenty more to jump in and become involved. That's why I want to mention this. Madison East Side Co-Housing and Co-Housing at Union Corners.
All right. Thank you very much for the call, Fawn. Well, it turns out, Chris, there are a lot of people in Wisconsin who were looking into this, right, or started it years ago.
Sounds like it. I mean, Wisconsin is always on the cutting edge of a lot of things, it seems.
Right. Do you want to respond to that, Jerry? Are you surprised to hear all of this?
Well, no, I'm not surprised because I know some of the people involved in those two new communities there in Madison. And I should mention that there are already three existing co-housing communities in Madison, and they're quite a variety. They show the diversity of co-housing. One is in basically a single building with apartments, and yet they have some common spaces as well. Another one is an infill project, which a caller mentioned earlier, where they bought houses on a block, and they built some new, but they mostly reused the existing homes. And then there's a community out on the north side of Madison, Troy Gardens, that was built from the ground up on bare land, but it was done as an affordable housing project. And so there's quite a variety out there. And I want to mention that we are working with a national organization that is concerned about affordable co-housing. In fact, the name of the organization is the Partnership for Affordable Co-Housing, and the folks there are helping us to plan and go forward with about one-third of our units being affordable here in Viroqua.
Uh-huh. Great. Thank you, Fawn, very much for your enthusiasm and your interest and knowledge. Tony in Egg Harbor, hi.
Hi, Kathleen. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
If a person owns a home and they just want to open it up for boarders and they're going to use great discretion in who they open the home up to, what issues does that homeowner have in relationship to discrimination?
That's a good question. I'm not sure I know the answer to it, to be perfectly honest. But certainly there are some issues with Fair Housing Act and having to navigate that. So I'm not sure specifically what you're asking about, but you probably have to ask someone who, a real estate agent or an attorney of some sort, I would imagine.
And have you had to deal, Jerry, with these kinds of issues of non-discrimination, et cetera, for Stone's Throw Eco Village?
No, we haven't. The example of someone's own home is just entirely different from what we're planning. And as I mentioned, we're open to anyone who wants to join. So there's no discriminating going on.
Mm-hmm. Facebook message from co-housing coaches. Let me see if you both agree with this. Think of it more like a small town or an old-fashioned village. Everybody has their own home, their own kitchen, but you share a common house, like a condo clubhouse on steroids. Gardens, lawns, way more than anyone could afford or who would want to maintain on their own. It sounds like some of the concerns from previous posts here are about co-householding or co-living, which are more like roommates under one roof.
Right. That's it's just a completely different concept from co-housing, where private homes, individual ownership, that's a basic element of co-housing.
So if you were to sell your house, Jerry, I know it's not built yet, but down the road, if you wanted to leave it, would that be a hard thing to do, or is it just sort of like selling a house?
Well, I think it would only be hard emotionally. When we were part of Rosewind Co-Housing in the state of Washington, we sold our place. And every co-housing community that I know of has had homes turn over, that is, people have moved on. And so you put your house up on the market, and you might think that it could take a little bit longer to find someone who wants to fit into the community. But in most markets, the houses sell quickly. So I don't anticipate any problem with that.
We have a couple lines open if you want to join our conversation. We're talking about co-housing this hour of the show, and our number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655, email talk at WPR.org, and lines are open for you right now. Thank you, Tony, for your call. Jerome in Mequon, hi.
Yes, thank you for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
My question is, what is the difference, basic difference, between co-housing and a condominium development that has maybe a community room or center and workout center, perhaps, and maybe even a swimming pool?
Chris?
Yeah, it could legally be not much, but when it comes to how it's actually administered, it might have a substantial difference. For instance, a lot of co-housing developments, but by no means all, are organized as condo associations, in that, each owner might own some, the paint in, as it were. But they also might all be members of the board, the condo board. So they might be all making decisions unanimously or at least collectively as far as administering shared resources or community areas would be. Whereas in a lot of traditional condos, you have a portion of people on the board of making those decisions. And some may have more of a sense of collective ownership than others. But in co-housing, it would generally be more towards the collective side of a sense of community. But legally, it could be a condo.
Hmm. Mm-hmm. What was it that, it's interesting that you've been in another co-housing arrangement, Jerry. What's so appealing to you about this arrangement?
I'm glad you asked that question. We specifically went to Port Townsend because there was a co-housing community there, and we had, our son was very young at the time, and we thought it would be a great place for kids, and it was.
Mm.
It was wonderful because the community was designed so that there was a central green space that the homes looked out onto. The vehicles were kept to the perimeter. And so there was a completely safe place in the center of the neighborhood for kids to play. And our son and the other kids in the community could run out there and play anytime. And some people will certainly search for a community that has other kids if they have children, and that's one of the big reasons. Also, for my wife and I, we like to share with other people regularly, and it's easy when you have the common house and you can share a dinner a couple nights a week there. It's easy to get together and keep up with everyone and share resources and that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm. Does it
certainly a guest room is a common thing I heard a lot too, where you have someone visiting and it can be a shared bedroom or living unit for various family members or friends of the people living in the co-housing association that they take care of.
Yeah, that sounds nice. Chris, are you tempted to move? I don't know what your living arrangement is, but are you tempted to do the same? Are you?
Yeah, sort of. I am a little bit. I'll be honest. I'm 26 years old. I live in a apartment in Chicago, and so I am, you know, kind of administering public areas with my roommates. But in the larger sense, yeah, it certainly is. There are some things about it that aren't very attractive and kind of really interesting to learn about.
Mm-hmm. Thanks, Jerome, for the call. Beth in La Crosse, hi.
Hi, how are you today?
Fine, how are you?
Just great.
Good.
What a great show. I have had an idea for probably 10 years to do a co-housing with horses, having 5-8 families with enough land and share the barn, share the chores, because my job keeps me very busy in real estate. I can't do all the outside work myself.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know if there's anything like that out there. I'd be interested, and I'll take your talk off the air.
All okay? Right. Is there anything like that, Chris?
Sorry, like what exactly?
Horses. She wants people, you know, 5-8 families. They have horses because she's got an outside job and she can't do all of the work herself. So do I, you know, have like-minded people who have horses?
Yeah, I'm not familiar with any personally, but it certainly would fit in the model. And there's not a hard number on exactly how many co-housing associations exist in the U.S., but it's somewhere around 130 now. And by the, you know, association's estimates, growing faster than it had been in 10 years before. So certainly room for that sort of thing.
Well, hasn't this been interesting? It's always fun to talk about new ways of doing things and new ways of living. Chris, thank you for writing the article. And if it weren't for you, we wouldn't be talking about this whole issue this hour. So thank you very much.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, and Jerry, all the best with the construction and the new home.
Thank you. Can I mention our website, Kathleen?
Why not?
Okay. It's stonesthrowcommunity.wordpress.com. You can see that on the Kathleen Dunn Show Facebook page also, where I posted it in the comments.
Great.
And
okay.
We're having our first open house on March 28th, once the snow melts, we think.
Yeah, it better. It just better. Or we're going to be doing co-housing somewhere else. No,
right.
Yeah. Thank
right.
you both so much. Our thanks to Chris Bentley, freelance writer. His piece on co-housing caught our attention, and so that's on our Facebook page, too, in case you missed the article in City Lab, the Atlantic publication. And thanks also to Jerry McIntyre. Jerry is one of the initial founders of the Stone's Throw Eco Village in Viroqua, Wisconsin. Thanks to KP Whaley for producing this interesting show and to Scotty Myers for on-air production here in downtown Milwaukee. Join us for great conversations ahead and tomorrow at 1.